all the songs, that song, they all fit together very well, or fits together very well with the topic tonight. I purposely did not mention the title of the sermon this morning when I was inviting you to come back, because one person heard the title and they threatened not to come as soon as they heard it. The title of this evening is Contentment. That person said, as soon as they heard that title, that's not something I want to hear about. So I didn't mention that. I'm glad you're here, because now you're stuck. You have to listen to what God has to say on the subject of contentment. And we all know that could be a little painful, probably. Last week we looked at three verses that tie in very closely to the verses we're going to look at tonight. We're turning back again to the book of Ecclesiastes. We'll be picking up at the start of chapter 6. But our passage tonight is coupled very close to the three verses that we looked at last week. We probably could consider that part one of a two-part sermon, but I did not want to extend things too long last week with our business meeting, and tonight gets long enough the way it is, so I did split it. But we really have to look at these two together, these pieces. For a few weeks now, we've been circling around this general topic of money. Solomon keeps coming back to that as we've been tracing our way through the book of Ecclesiastes. He's coming back, and for 3 or 4 weeks now, we've been dealing with money. Money is one of those primary realities in our life that leads to so many frustrating perplexities, doesn't it? There's times where money just seems to escape how we can be content with it. It seems to be a never-ending enigma. It's another of what Solomon would call hevel, that Hebrew word that we've seen time and time again. This is hevel, that term that we have translated in our versions as vanity or meaningless, that means this is something that is a frustrating perplexity in life. We just can't quite understand it fully. Money is one of those elements that fits that topic very well, isn't it? It's a frustrating perplexity. I don't know about you, but I expect you're probably like me, where you've been often frustrated by the perplexity of money. It's just not there when it should be. We've seen several different ideas along that line at play in the last several weeks, haven't we? We've been bouncing around the very issues that come up in our lives as we interact with money. If we don't have any, then we've seen it's impossible for us to enjoy the life that God has given us. But if we have some, our sinfulness always yearns for more. And that brings a lack of contentment to life, because we can never be satisfied. We have that ever-too-present temptation to live our lives for the pursuit of money. And that leads to life as what Solomon summarized here in chapter 5, verse 17, a life of darkness with great vexation, sickness, and anger. Not a pleasant life when we live our life in pursuit of money. It is a miserable existence, in fact. Last week, we looked at the stance that we should take towards money as we looked at verses 18 through 20. We should recognize that any ability that we have to find joy in life is a gift from God. And that includes the ability to enjoy money. It only comes as a gift from God. Separate from that, we cannot enjoy it. Money comes as a reward that we get from all the efforts in life. When God gives us abilities to do things in life, we get money as a reward. But that reward is not sufficient to give us enjoyment. God is the only one who can empower us to enjoy the results of that ability and the money that comes from it. But even that only comes when we have a God-centered perspective. We can never enjoy life except outside of that God-centered perspective. When we use money in pursuit of a life that's focused on Him, then we find enjoyment. And He rewards us with that joy. Such joy can make our lives very pleasant. The last thing we saw last week, and Solomon says in verse 20, that God keeps us occupied with gladness in our heart. It's a great way to go through life when we're focused on God, that we can be occupied with gladness. Yet if we think about it, even this doesn't bring ultimate meaning into life. Solomon, along this whole path, has been searching for what is it that would bring ultimate meaning to life. Is there any lasting value? And as we come to chapter 6, Solomon will continue to consider this enigma that we call money. He's just considered the ability to enjoy the wealth that we should have if we recognize that every bit of our money is a gift from God. But what happens then if God doesn't grant that gift? It's not automatic, is it? God may not grant the gift of enjoyment. A gift, by definition, is something that's freely given. It's not obligated. It's not something that's guaranteed. So Solomon, he's just told us that we should have a God-centered perspective, and as a result of that God-centered perspective, we may be able to have the gift of enjoyment. And then he says, but what happens if we don't? What if we do not have that? God's not obligated to give us that gift. He's not obligated to let us enjoy money. God in His sovereignty may choose not to enable us to enjoy it at all. He may give us wealth, but not the ability to enjoy it. So that's the final question that Solomon is going to explore as he wraps up what's really the first half of this book. At the end of chapter 6, we transition to a second half of the book, and as he wraps this up, he's going to deal with this final question. What happens if God does not give us the gift of enjoyment? What do we do then? How do we have that God-centered perspective? The whole first half, Solomon has dealt with various observations of life. All these things that he's observed, that he looks around and sees the situation that mankind's in, and he says, in all of these observations, I do not find any ultimate meaning in life. There's nothing here that we've accomplished as in what I can observe that gives lasting value. Money is just one of those. And as he thinks about that, it becomes most perplexing. Then where is value in life? Is there any real meaning? So again, we're going through that overall lesson, but the immediate lesson tonight is different. It's part of that overall, but is there immediate lesson? What should be our lesson if we're unable to enjoy the wealth that God gives us? What is the point of this passage? We'll consider that tonight. I believe the overall point comes in understanding this passage. As we see it go through, we hit a final parable at the end. And as we've seen before, Solomon a lot of times gives us the punch of the passage in one of those wrap-up parables. And that's what it does here. Tonight, the lesson that he gives us is we need to be content with whatever God has given us. We need to be content. Let's begin looking at our passage tonight. Solomon, he lays out the scenario for us to consider in the first two verses. And in these verses, we discover the frustration that comes with not being able to enjoy our money. Look at verses 1 and 2. Solomon says, there is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is prevalent among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that his soul lacks nothing at all that he desires. Yet, God has not empowered him to eat from them, for a foreigner enjoys them. This is vanity and a severe affliction. The scenario he gives us here is that non-ability to enjoy money. What happens if we have a non-ability? God doesn't grant it. I mentioned this is really the beginning, or the second part of a two-part series here, if we consider last week's sermon. Solomon's purposefully made these two verses a direct contrast to the previous ones. For example, verse 18 of chapter 5 starts out, here is what I've seen to be good. Now in verse 1 of chapter 6, he says, there is an evil which I've seen by comparison. Here's something good, here's something evil. On the one hand is something good, on the other hand there's something evil. I've seen them both. He's contrasting. Verse 19 of chapter 5, Solomon writes, for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth. Now in verse 2, he refers to man to whom God has given riches and wealth. In this case, even honor. Again, he's putting two comparisons. I've seen a man that has basically the identical situation, yet one is good and one's not. Clearly his goal is to contrast these two situations. He sets up this example here so that this person in our second scenario that we're looking at tonight has all the same rewards for his labors. He's worked the same way as the person who was given the gift by God of enjoying his wealth. So he sets this up where this person has a reward for his labor. This person has a reward for his labor. They're the same. God's blessed this person with great financial blessings. From a human standpoint, he has everything that a member of high society or nobility should expect to have. In fact, if we compare things, 2 Chronicles 1:12, the same three terms are used when God tells Solomon that God says, I will give you riches and wealth and honor. God was promising to give Solomon all these things, and now Solomon says, here's a man that has those. He has all these things. God was promising Solomon, I'll make you the greatest king there's ever been. And Solomon says, now I've seen a man that has the same things that I have. He has everything. But what we need to see is that the similarities between these two are just set so that we can build up the contrast between the one key point. They make the contrast more stark. The difference between the two lies in that free sovereign choice of God. This person, he decides to give the gift of enjoyment. This person, he does not. In fact, God is the only one who can make this choice. Solomon's building on the idea from last week. The ability to enjoy our wealth is given as a gift by God. God has to empower us. Remember, he used that word for empowerment that says have dominion or power over something. It's only when God gives us the power over our wealth can we enjoy it. Now Solomon's saying, here's a person that has all of it, but God doesn't give him that. He's not empowered. He cannot enjoy it. God doesn't give him that. Without that ability, the person is unable to enjoy any of the wealth, even though he has all this wealth, all this honor. None of it counts for anything. He can't partake in any of the rewards for his own labors. Instead, Solomon takes the scenario one step further. He says, instead, a person who's completely unconnected to him, he calls him a foreigner, somehow receives and enjoys all the benefits of his reward. Everything the man's worked for, everything he's accumulated, goes to someone else. Notice he doesn't give us any details about how that situation comes about. Most likely he does that intentionally. You know, there are ways that God can prevent someone from enjoying their wealth. If you think about it, those ways are nearly endless. There could be a business calamity. There could be an economic collapse. There could be a governmental shift. There could be death. There could be an illness. Solomon doesn't pick out any of those specifics. He just leaves it general, so that our mind can focus in on the contrast between the two. But notice that absent of detail, it makes it separate here from what we saw in chapter 5, 10 through 17. There we had a lot of detail. There the focus was on a person who improperly pursued wealth for wealth's sake. So I believe what the lack of detail should at least tell us that Solomon's not trying to say that this person necessarily had an improper theological perspective. He wasn't like the person we saw back in verses 10 through 17 that was chasing wealth for wealth's sake. That was his goal in life. He's making this the worst case scenario. Here's a person that has all the right theological understanding, and God chooses in his sovereignty not to let him enjoy it. He's intentionally opening that up so that we can think about the most troubling, the most frustrating, the most perplexing situation we can imagine. Someone who has all the right God-centered perspective, but doesn't get to enjoy it. Doesn't get to enjoy his wealth because of God's sovereign choice. It wasn't through any action on his part at all. Think about that. That makes something a very frustrating perplexity. That is hevel. He says, this is vanity. This is hevel, a frustrating perplexity. It's a severe affliction. Let's bring that into our ideas. Here, a couple weeks ago, I was reading a news story that I think demonstrates this type of situation. The focus of the story was on an obscure law that allowed a man in Texas to claim a $300,000 house for $16 through a legal maneuver called an adverse possession. An adverse possession, according to the article, allows an individual to take property that's considered abandoned. And the article says apparently all 50 states have provisions on their books covering this concept. It apparently came from back in the days when boundaries of farmlands weren't always clear. The basic idea was that if a homeowner put down a fence and it went for a period of time not being contested, that everything on this side of the fence is my land, over a period of time, without a claim being made against it, then the person had some sort of common law claim that his land went to that fence. That's the basic idea of the law. Well, here in the case in Texas that was being mentioned in the article, a man moved into a foreclosed home worth $330,000 after he paid $16 of a filing fee of some kind at a local courthouse. If the man stays in the house for 3 years, he can obtain the title and become the legal owner to that house. The man told the newspaper that the original owner would have to pay off a massive mortgage. That's why he's not living there. Or the bank would have to file a complex lawsuit to override his squatter's rights that he's initiated here. And he considered both of those unlikely. He expects for 3 years he'll get to live there, and after the end of that, own this house. Now that doesn't feel right, does it? It's completely unfair. In fact, many of the neighbors apparently agreed. I'm sure these are all people that were living in a neighborhood. If you got a $330,000 house, I expect the other houses are going to be comparable. Neighbors are living in houses they've worked and paid for. They called the police on the man and said, this man doesn't belong there, throw him out. And according to the article, the police did not. The police determined that they could not remove the man from the house because this was a civil matter, not a criminal one. He had filed the proper paper at the courthouse. Now, what's not mentioned in the article is what happened to the original owner. But if we think about the concept from the context of our passage, put yourself in the perspective of the original owner. I think he's exactly the kind of man Solomon's talking about here. This man apparently had sufficient wealth to build this nice house, or at least to initiate a mortgage on this house. But now, through some stroke of fate, otherwise known as God's providential oversight of his sovereign plan, right? Through something that God brought into this person's life, the man can no longer enjoy that house, but some other man that's totally unconnected to him for a measly $16 is living in that house. I'm sure that if the original owner knows about the situation, he'd be in agreement with Solomon. This is frustrating perplexity and a severe affliction. This isn't fair. That's exactly the type of situation that we might be confronted with when we go through life, a life that's controlled by the sovereign hand of God. Solomon's observed it. He's talked about different scenarios. If you think about it, so have we. There's things in life that just don't seem fair because we don't understand God's purposes. And that lack of understanding brings us to these frustrating perplexities. In fact, Solomon now goes on so far to call this a great tragedy. In the next several verses, he's going to bluntly state that a person would have been better to never have life, to have been miscarried, than to experience such a frustration. Let's look at our verses, begin at verse 3 of the chapter. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, however many they be, but his soul is not satisfied with good things, and he does not even have a proper burial, then I say better the miscarriage than he. For it comes in futility and goes into obscurity, and his name is covered in obscurity. It never sees the sun, it never knows anything. It is better off than he. Even if the other man lives 1,000 years twice, and does not enjoy good things, do not all go to the one place? Here Solomon engages in a great deal of hyperbole in these voices, or in these verses here, to make his point. Not only enjoying our wealth, or not being able to enjoy our wealth, is a great tragedy from our perspective. He asks us now, picture a man that's blessed beyond our comprehension. He's taken the scenario he just painted and now going to hyperbolic extremes. Picture this man. Here's a man who has 100 children. When this is in a day and age, of course, where children's considered a mark of blessing, right? So the man's blessed beyond measure. He's got 100 children. He lives many years, even up to 1,000, twice over. Again, age is considered a sign of blessing. This man's blessed beyond imagination. Through it all, he's able to accumulate much. Yet in the end, he's not able to enjoy any of it. For some reason, he doesn't have the enjoyment even of a decent burial at the end of his life. He goes through all of his life without being empowered by God to enjoy any of the rewards that come from that extremely long life. Solomon paints this picture in this hyperbole to paint this as this is an absolute tragedy from our perspective. Notice the contrast. He says a child who is miscarried or is stillborn is better off than this man. That's how extreme the tragedy is. This child never experiences anything in life. The child is never known in any personal way. That brief, short life that he or she leads is one conducted in obscurity. The life was all in the womb. It was never under the sun. He says that condition is better off than this man who doesn't get to enjoy any of the reward because God doesn't grant that. Why is the child better off? Because even the child who never experienced any of the joys of life has also never experienced any of the pain. When compared to this man who lives this long life that's filled with one painful experience after another, Solomon says this child is better off. Solomon considers the child more blessed of the two. In the end, he says both the child and the man are going to die. All will end up in the same place. They're both going to end up in the grave. That's a given. But the child went there without experiencing any of the pain and the anguish that living in this sin-cursed world brings. The man experienced nothing but that. Now clearly the focus of the passage here is not on the miscarriage or the stillborn child. The focus is on the tragedy of the man who God never empowers to live the life. But I do recognize that there are many here today who have experienced personally having a child miscarry. So I want to make a few side comments that I do believe we can bring from this passage, even though they're not the primary focus. I think these are points which should be a comfort and encouragement to any of you that have experienced this in your life. First of all, I want you to notice that Solomon is comparing two lives. He's comparing the man and the child. There's two lives. That means the child, even though it was never born, was just as much alive as the man who lived for 1,000 years twice over. It was a real life. The child's life was just as real before God as the man's. That tells me that every miscarriage or every stillborn child was a human life, and it cannot be seen as anything else. It was a life. The image of God was part of that child, and for that reason, that child's life was important to God. Secondly, the child's life began at conception and ended at death, just like the life of every person who passes through birth. In fact, that's the point Solomon's making. They end up at the same place. They start life and they end life. They both end up in the grave. The child's life began at conception and ended at death, just like every life, even for those who pass through birth in between. Between birth and death are a number of days determined according to that sovereign plan of God. Much like the topic of this passage, where we may not understand everything that's going on, we don't know why God allows for one person to enjoy their wealth and another person not to. It's a frustrating perplexity. We don't understand why God's plan for one life may involve going through birth and living for a number of years, and for another life it doesn't. What we do know is that God has complete control over each and every day of every life. So during those days, God uses each life to accomplish everything that His plan has to bring glory to Himself. The miscarried child has fulfilled his or her purpose in God's plan perfectly. The miscarried child has had exactly the number of days God said that child needed to bring the display of glory that God intended from that life. Even if how that can be remains a mystery to us, it's a fact. The last point that I see in these verses is that there's a valid reason to consider the child blessed. The child was spared the experience of any of the pain that comes from living in this sin-cursed world. You think about it. We all sit here experiencing the pain that comes from living in a sin-cursed world. Even the grief that we feel when a child miscarries is part of the pain that comes from living in a sin-cursed world. The child never experienced any of that. While we grieve because of all the unfulfilled expectations that we had for the child never experiences any of that. Frankly, that is something that none of us can comprehend because all of us have experienced grief. We're living under the sun. We live in this sin-cursed world. We know nothing else. But the child has been spared of all that. So those are three points that I believe we can draw up from this passage that briefly touches on a miscarriage or stillbirth that tells us, first of all, it's a real life, its days were under God's control and accomplished exactly what God wanted, in an aspect, that child is blessed because it never experiences any of the pain that we go through. Now, as we come back to the main point here, Solomon's passage, let's see how he brings this all together. Remember, his contrast is dealing with the ability to enjoy the money that we're given from our labor. Can we find enjoyment in life? What do we do when God enables this person to enjoy it, but this person not to? How do we handle that? He concludes with three parables. Let's look at those beginning in verse 7. All of a man's labor is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage does the wise man have over the fool? What advantage does the poor man have, knowing how to walk before the living? What the eyes see is better than what the soul desires. This too is futility and striving after wind. He pulls all these threads of thoughts together here with these three final parables. He does see it as a tragedy that the man's not able to enjoy any of the rewards of his labor. It's a great tragedy, a severe affliction, that God doesn't grant him any of that ability. Look at the first parable in verse 7. All a man's labor is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. The point here is that the purpose of our working is to meet our needs. That's why we're given the ability to work, so that we can meet our needs. That's been a repeated idea throughout these first six chapters, that God gives us the blessing of work. We have necessities of life. God gives us the ability to meet those necessities through the rewards of our labor. Yet a part of the reality of living in the synchronous world is that we're never satisfied with what we have. We always struggle with that. Even as we strive to keep a God-centered focus, we still struggle with that contentment, that satisfaction, because we want a little bit more. We're naturally self-focused because of our sin nature. We struggle with staying God-focused. Then he follows up with the next proverb. For what advantage does the wise man have over the fool? What advantage does the poor man have knowing how to walk before the living? If you notice, the word advantage has been added to the second line there by most of our translations is in italics, so that means it's added, but regularly so. It gives us the idea. As Solomon's wrapping up this first half of his book, he's restating the big question. Remember, the big question that came at the very beginning is, what advantage do we have from this life? That's another word that he used for ultimate gain. Is there anything that comes from this life that gives us ultimate gain? Since in our sinful nature we're never satisfied, is there any way in which the wise man has any ultimate gain over the fool? Well, all the way back in chapter 2, verse 15, Solomon gave us an answer to that question. Does the wise man have ultimate advantage over the fool? No. He has relative advantage. He can go through life with less pain than the fool, but there's not ultimate advantage to a wise man because both end up the same. They die. The same thing's true with wealth. That's the comparison he's making. Just like the wise man and the fool don't have any difference when it comes to ultimate advantage, same with wealth. The wealthy man does not have any ultimate advantage. In fact, the poor man may have a relative advantage at time because he knows how to live properly among the living. He's not so focused on pursuing wealth. Wealth can be a great hindrance. Remember, Christ said it's easier to go for a camel through an eye of a needle than for rich man to find the kingdom of God. The poor man may have a relative advantage, but it's not ultimate advantage. There's no ultimate advantage in being either rich or poor. It's all relative. In the end, death is the great equalizer. The rich man and the poor man end up in the same place. So what is his conclusion? We come to it here in the last parable. What the eyes see is better than what the soul desires. What the eyes see is better than what the soul desires. At first, that parable may seem a little obscure, but if you think about it for just a moment, I think you're going to see the point. One commentator notes this close to our modern parable, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. The same idea here. Solomon's point is that we should be satisfied with what our eyes see right in front of us. That we have right there. Not be chasing after those things that are not in our possession. even if it's something that's greatly desired by our soul, if we don't have it right in front of us, we have no guarantee we'll ever see it. Now, just be clear, the word we have translated here as souls, it's not pointing to our eternal soul. It's a word that refers to our immortal or immaterial part of our life, our life force, our being. It could be translated even that which makes us a living person. So that's what he's talking about. What the eyes see is better than that which the living person desires. What we're thinking, what we can think about in our mind and yearn for, isn't what where our focus should be. Our focus should be what's right in front of us, what we already have. It's simply an idiom here that says we should not be driven by our desires, because those are going to be yielding to our sinful, self-focused nature. The secret to contentment is to be focused on that which we legitimately possess, not what we don't. Our appetite for more and more of anything is going to constantly grow if we allow ourselves to focus on it. It's going to lead to discontentment as we think and think about what we don't have, instead of just being content with what we have. Trying to satisfy our souls is an impossible task, because we always think of more that we want. Enjoying what we already have is not impossible. God's already given that to us. God has already given us what is in our possession. The trick is to learn to be content with that. A number of years ago, there was popular radio and then an early TV program called The Goldbergs. In one episode, Jake Goldberg came home for supper and excitedly told his wife, Molly, about a great idea he had. He wanted to go into business. Molly had been putting money aside, anticipating just such a thing, and she gave it to him. As they sat around the table enthusiastically discussing the future, Jake said, Molly, someday we're going to be eating off golden plates. Molly looked at him and replied, Jake, darling, will it taste any better? She had the point. The lesson that Solomon wraps up this passage and the entire first half of the book with here is that we need to be content with whatever God has given us. Again, that's just one of those basic ideas, isn't it? We all know that, don't we? There's nothing shocking in that statement. We all know that God has given us exactly everything that we need to fulfill His purpose for our lives. Nothing's lacking. We all know that He's given us what we need to display His glory. So why is it so hard to live out that principle? If it's that easy to understand, why is it so hard? Well, I think the hard part comes because of the way I worded it. We need to be content with whatever God has given us. If you think about it, that doesn't begin to imply that God will give us everything we want. And therein lies the rub, doesn't it? We need to be content with whatever God has given us. Let's bring that right down to the context of our passage here. God may not even give us the ability to enjoy the wealth that we have. Now, none of us are extremely wealthy in this room, but we all have wealth. But He may not give us the ability to enjoy that. He may take all of our wealth away. He may bring a calamity into our lives that takes everything that we've set aside for our enjoyment away from us. You know, we've set stuff aside for our retirement, and suddenly it's gone. Are we still going to be content? He may bring a calamity into our lives that leave us physically unable to enjoy the wealth the way we plan on it. You know, we have all this money set aside, and now we're physically unable to partake of it, to do what we were planning to do. Are we still content? He may leave us financially limited to such an extent that we're convinced there's not even any wealth for us to enjoy. Are we content? How? How are we to be content in whatever circumstances that God brings? Well, we need to focus our attention on what He has given us. We are rich already. We are rich because of what we already have before our eyes. You know, even if you think about our relative wealth, we're rich compared to the rest of the world. Even the poorest person sitting here today has more material means than half the people in the world today. God has blessed us with roofs over our heads, meals on our table. We all had transportation to come here tonight. You're here. God has blessed us with those things. We all have more clothes at home than what we're wearing right now. We have electricity. We have running water. We have appliances that heat and cool our food. We have so much that we should be content with already. But much more important than any of that, we have Jesus Christ already. We know about Him. God may remove all these things that I've listed from us, but we still have the wonder that we sung about tonight, the salvation of our Savior. We have Jesus Christ. God Himself has guaranteed that Christ's death and Christ's resurrection is sufficient to pay the penalty for our sin. That can never be taken away. We have an eternity in heaven before our eyes. Are we content with that? We have an eternity of worshiping our God and Savior in front of us. That's where we should be focused. That's where our contentment should come from. We should be echoing what the psalmist says in Psalm 73, 25 and 26. Whom have I in heaven but You? And besides You, I desire nothing on earth. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. The psalmist learned about contentment. God is sufficient no matter what else we have or don't have. We have our Savior. God may remove all of our physical forms of wealth. He may, in His sovereign plan, choose not to enable us to enjoy any of the rewards of our labor. But He will never take our Savior from us. Why do we struggle with contentment? Because we focus on what we do not have instead of what we do. Why do we struggle? Because life is hell. It's a frustrating perplexity. It's striving after the wind. It's trying to chase that which is impossible to control from our perspective. But all of that should be balanced with the reality that God is in control. And we need to be content with whatever God has given us. Let's close in prayer.